Growing up as the son of a coach in the NFL, sportscaster Jerry Sandusky got to hobnob with Johnny Unitas, Dan Marino, and other football greats. In a new memoir, Jerry profiles his late father, John Sandusky, a tough, demanding, but respected football man who had a brief tenure as head coach of the old Baltimore Colts in a career that started as a player with the Cleveland Browns in the 1950s and ran for 43 years. Jerry describes his family's triumphs and sorrows on and off the field, as well as his public and private struggles when an unrelated college coach with the same name brought infamy to Penn State. Jerry Sandusky, that's Jerry with a G, joins me on Midday after the news from NPR. And welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us. Our next guest's last name should be familiar. For more than 50 years, it's been associated with football in Baltimore and the United States. The late John Sandusky was a 43-year NFL veteran who started in 1950 as a lineman for the Cleveland Browns and went on to a distinguished career on the sidelines. He was a line coach and briefly head coach of the Baltimore Colts before they became the Indianapolis Ursays, as the legendary sportscaster Vince Bagley used to say. John Sandusky went on to coach in Philadelphia for three seasons, and then for 19 years in Miami with his friend and mentor, Don Shula. Along the way, he won championships and the respect of fans and fellow professionals. His 35-year marriage to Ruth Sandusky produced five children, the youngest of whom is here to tell us about his father's life and their loving but sometimes difficult relationship, a story that will resonate with fathers and sons in all walks of life. Jerry Sandusky, that's Jerry with a G, and that's very important, is sports director of WBAL-TV and the radio play-by-play voice of the Baltimore Ravens. He literally grew up on the sidelines of the NFL, and his new memoir, Forgotten Sundays, describes what it was like to be a kid whose father worked in the fishbowl of the NFL, in a profession where he was largely absent from home for 6 months of the year and always had to work on Sundays. Jerry describes his father as demanding as a father as he was as a coach, but underneath there was an abiding love that it took his children many years to fully appreciate. Jerry Sandusky describes the family's triumphs and sorrows and the heartbreaking deterioration of John's memory as he slowly succumbed to Alzheimer's. Jerry also describes the pain and hatred that his family was subjected to after 2011 because of an unfortunate coincidence. He shares a name with Jerry Sandusky, that's Jerry with a J, the unrelated assistant coach at Penn State who was convicted of child molestation. Jerry with a G tells us how he and his family dealt with an almost unbelievable torrent of misplaced hatred and survived. Jerry Sandusky is sports director at WBAL-TV, the radio play-by-play voice, as I say, of the Baltimore Ravens, and he's a frequent guest on the NFL Network, ESPN Radio, and other outlets. His new book about his father, the longtime NFL coach John Sandusky, is called Forgotten Sundays, A Son's Story of Life, Loss, and Love from the Sidelines of the NFL. The publisher is Running Press. Jerry with a G, Sandusky, it's nice to have you on the show.
Great to be with you, old friend.
Nice to see you after a long time. I hear your voice doing Ravens game, and I see you on TV. It's nice to get you in Studio A with us.
Well, it's great to be in the studio of the show I listen to all the time.
Excellent. Well, let's deal with that, what you deal with at the start of your book and at the end of the book, that subject of your name. So let's talk about that. And so here's my first question to you. Where were you when you first realized that your good name and reputation was taking a beating?
I was on the Ravens charter flight to Pittsburgh, of all places, and I'm checking in, and the team security, two of the security members, looked at me and said, hey, did a member of your family get arrested? And I thought, you know, I just talked to my brother Jim earlier that day. I'm sure if somebody in the family got arrested, I would have heard about it. Right. And I said, no. And then they said, Jerry Sandusky, the Penn State coach. And so I just brushed it off. I said, no, I've heard that over the years. We're not related. So whatever happened, no relation. Didn't think about it.
So you knew of him?
Oh, yeah. I knew. I had actually interviewed him once years before and did a story about the fact that you know, we had the same sounding name and the irony of it. Mm-hmm. Never thinking it would ever lead to our paths crossing again. Well, by midway through the flight to Pittsburgh, Colin Ward, our game producer, had Wi-Fi on the plane, so he pulls up the stories and leans over and said, oh, this is bad. And, you know, like yourself, having worked in the media for so long, I knew in a flash this was going to be around a long time.
So when did you start hearing from people who thought you were that Sandusky?
That night. So we get to Pittsburgh, and the 6 o'clock news hits. Keep in mind, this is Western Pennsylvania, where a lot of this is, you know, local news.
Right.
And for a half an hour, this was the most jarring thing, for a half an hour, every story was about the child molester. Well, when you hear the name that sounds exactly like yours, linked to these heinous crimes, I was nauseous by the end of the half hour. So, you know, I thought I'd get away from it. I went down to the lobby to try to get something to eat, and that's when I noticed people avoiding me, just looking at me. People on the team charter, people would talk to me all the time, but now they were uncomfortable. And the next day, people are avoiding me. And so the very next day, I'm out on the field at a Heinz Field, and Fred Gaudelli, I go into this in the book, Fred Gaudelli, the producer of Sunday Night Football, comes out on the field. He says, wow, I've been thinking of you. I've known him for a couple of years. He goes, but you've been going through it today. I said, yeah, it's been pretty weird. And he introduces me to Dick Ebersol, the longtime president of NBC Sports. For those who don't know, Dick Ebersol is probably one of the 5 most influential people in television ever. I mean, mm-hmm. This guy is a power broker. And I stick out my hand and I say, yeah, Mr. Ebersol, pleasure to meet you. I'm Jerry Sandusky. And he did what I've seen now hundreds of people do since. He visibly flinched. He pulled his hand back like mine was on fire, and within a minute, he had found another conversation farther down the field.
Hadn't these folks seen television or photographs of the Jerry Sandusky who was under arrest at Penn State?
Yeah, but they didn't know if that was my father, my uncle, my brother. You know,
okay.
And you know what? I think in our society, Dan, we are in such a surface, quick thinking mode
mm-hmm.
that people hear something and they don't take the time to digest it. I mean, on my Twitter handle, at Jerry Sandusky, it even says no relation to the former Penn State coach. But nobody takes the time to click through.
Right.
There would just be this unbelievable flood of hatred and anger.
Mm-hmm.
But along the way, so you'll learn a couple of things. One, people don't think very deeply. And two, the most powerful lesson I took away from this is hating is always about the hater. It's not about you.
What do you mean?
So on Twitter and Facebook and social media and mm-hmm. email, there were literally thousands of people who would invite me to spend eternity in hell and just say horrendous things to me and terrible things to my family.
Right.
And at first,
because they thought you were that guy.
They thought I was that guy. And so at first, it's overwhelming. I mean, it's literally like standing at the bottom of Niagara Falls and you're getting pummeled by this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden, the light switch went on and I realized, this is about them. This has nothing to do with me. Once you get to that point where you realize when people are hating Ferguson, Missouri, Iraq, the Middle East, when people are hating, it's about the hater.
I see.
It's not about what they're hating on. It's the problem. It always resides in the hater. They're expressing something inside of them.
Well, there's a lot of hate anyway, isn't there, on the internet, in social media?
It's a ton of it because people can hide behind it.
Yeah.
And vent.
But, you know, your misfortune here is that your name wasn't Dave Smith, Bill Smith, Jim White, some simple name like that. With, you know, there's a million guys by that name. You had this unusual name, Jerry Sandusky.
Yeah, there's 2 of them I've ever heard of,
right.
Me and the convicted child molester. And so you have to make a decision, if you're me, early on, what am I going to do? And literally thousands of people ask me, why don't you just change your name? And the book is largely the answer to that question, Dan, because another principle that I discovered along the way is the easy answer in the short term is almost never the right answer in the long term. That was the whole problem at Penn State to begin with. They went for easy short, mm-hmm. and they suffered long. So, yeah, I could change my name, but what happens if I change my name to something that becomes the next god-awful criminal? You can't keep running from it. And then, you know, later in the book, I talk about my father's battle with Alzheimer's, and that's when I realized the value of a name. We take our names for granted. I do not anymore, but I probably did to a large degree. You know, Dan Roderick has always been your name. You just, you know, and most of us have a good association with our name. That's human nature. At the end of my father's life, there came that moment where he looked at me, and he didn't know my name, and he didn't know his name. And I realized your name is not about ownership. It's not permanent. Like everything else in this life, it's temporary. It's about stewardship. It's about what you do with it for while you have it. And you're only going to have it for a finite period of time. And once I digested that concept, I was like, I can weather this. My family can weather this. And we'll come out on the other end stronger for it.
What I find particularly interesting about you is that you came back to Baltimore because you were here for a while as a kid and then spent a lot of years in Miami because your father took a job there with that football team down there. Is that the name Sandusky meant something in Baltimore for a long time. It was associated with the winning era of the Baltimore Colts. It was associated with just the very beginning of the Robert Irsay era, but mostly with a positive feeling people had about the name Sandusky. And then you come back to town as a sportscaster, right? So
right.
What was the reaction to your name in 1988 when you arrived up on TV Hill?
Very positive. Very positive. A lot of people remembered my father and linked it back to the
Colts. In a positive way,
right? In a very positive way. And you know, and this, you know, I came back to Baltimore. Not a lot of people have a career goal of moving from Miami to Baltimore. I mean, I understand that on the outside, that looks like, you know, okay, you've lost something up top. But, you know, I grew up here in the early part of my life. And I had just gotten married, and my wife and I decided we're going to have a family. And as crazy as this will sound, I didn't want to raise a family in South Florida. Nothing against South Florida, but I had lived in the North, and I'd lived in South Florida, and I wanted my kids to have the four seasons. I wanted my kids to have the sense of relying on the neighbors when it snows and you need help. I wanted that sense of community you only get in a place that has winter. You don't get that in a place that's eternal summer. And as much as I enjoyed South Florida, I decided I wanted to raise my family in Baltimore because I loved growing up in Baltimore, and that's what brought me back.
But there were still, in 1988, of course, the Colts had left town 4 years earlier. There were still a lot of people in mourning over the Baltimore Colts. There are fewer of them of those folks nowadays. But at the time, people must have been vivid in their minds that you were John Sandusky's son, possibly. People must have asked you that.
Yes and no. A lot of people used to confuse me with Alex Sandusky. He was the other Sandusky. He played guard for the Baltimore Colts in the 60s, and my dad was his position coach, and again, no relation.
Huh.
I mean, what are the odds of this? There's three Sanduskys. They're all in football. None of us are related. And so a lot of people used to think that Alex was my dad. So I'd have to say, no. John's my dad. He was Alex's coach, and they're like, oh, okay, great. So I'm used to the name confusion thing.
Right. Just to go back to wrap this up on the other Jerry Sandusky and the Penn State scandal, I remember, did you not do a commentary about this on, or a disclaimer of some kind on WBAL-TV?
Right out of the gate. I just let everybody know.
Yeah.
No, I'm not related. There's no relation. He's not my father. He's not my uncle. I understand the confusion. I understand the hatred.
Did you address it again after that publicly?
I did it on a Ravens broadcast, and then I've done it in interviews.
And when did it start to go away?
It has diminished, but anytime I leave town, it doesn't go away. Hmm. It's diminished in Baltimore. Most people have figured it out in Baltimore. The second I get on a plane and go someplace else, if I check into a hotel in Denver, the hotel clerk will do a double take and will ask me, would you like to check in under an assumed name?
No kidding. Oh, really?
Yeah,
they ask you that?
I'll usually get a lot of extra attention at the security at airports. Anytime I'm outside of Baltimore, it's like it happened last week.
And at the Super Bowl, did it trail you to the Super Bowl with the Ravens a couple years ago?
Absolutely, because, you know, the Super Bowl, you've been in those multimedia events where it's you and 50 other people lined up.
Yeah.
So I would be getting ready to do a live shot, and I'd have 40 reporters to either side of me, and I'd be on the air, and I'd say something like, you know, I'm Jerry Sandusky in New Orleans, and all 80 would just stop what they were doing, turn and look at me. And so I've actually gotten used to it, and it's an icebreaker now. Because like anything, if you embrace it, if you own it, and if you don't react negatively to it, it will become part of your life in a positive way. And here's the great positive, Dan. I never have to be introduced twice at a party.
Jerry Sandusky is our guest visiting us today from TV Hill, WBAL Television, and the play-by-play voice of the Baltimore Ravens. He's got a new book out, a memoir of his, really it's a story about his father, and we're going to talk about John Sandusky after this break. The book is called Forgotten Sundays, A Son's Story of Life, Loss, and Love from the Sidelines of the NFL. If you'd like to ask Jerry Sandusky a question as the hour rolls along here, this is how you reach us. 410-662-8780 is the number for Midday. Our email address, midday@wypr.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday. Dan Roderick's here with Jerry Sandusky. So the book, you set off to write the book really about your dad, right?
Because
you thought, well, did people say to you, one of these days you have to write a story about your dad, or was this something you wanted to do?
You know, it was something I'd wanted to do for years, long before the name thing even came about. I wanted to write a story about my dad, but as the prototype, because there's so many people like my dad. You know, you see Don Shula, you see John Harbaugh, you see Jim Harbaugh and Bill Cowher, the head coaches, the guys who are in the spotlight constantly, but you don't see the cadre of men who are just around them on the skirts of the spotlight, whose lives revolve around that, whose families' lives revolve around that, and generationally what that means and the sacrifice these men make and how they really are the definition of what creates great teams. So I wanted to write a story that shared what life is like for these men beyond the 3 hours you see them on the field.
Your dad came out of World War II, and how old was he at the end of World War II as a veteran?
Let's see. He went into World War II as an 18-year-old. He would have been 20 when he came out and then went to Villanova on the GI Bill.
So he went to college after the war, and then he was drafted by the Cleveland Browns?
Right. He was the 18th player drafted in the 1950 draft. If he had been the 18th player drafted in this year's draft, he would have probably signed a contract worth about $14 million. The deal he signed in 1950 worth $5,000, and his signing bonus was a steak dinner.
No
kidding. I always say, God, I hope that was a good steak.
So he was an offensive lineman.
Right. He was an offensive tackle.
And how did he do?
He was great. He played for the Browns for 6 years. They were in the championship for 6 years. He got traded to the Green Bay Packers in his seventh year, played there for a year just before Lombardi got there. And then, as players did in the 50s, they had to make a decision, my dad and my mom, that, you know, we've got kids now. We can't afford to keep playing football. I mean, think of that.
Yeah.
You know, in today's age, you try to play another year or so because you can set yourself up for life. Back then, it was, I got to go figure out my life's work here because I don't know that we can keep doing this and moving the kids around. We can't afford to have a place in Philly and a place in Cleveland and have kids. We just can't afford to do it anymore.
So by the time you were born, 1961, am I right?
Right.
61, you were the youngest of five. Where was your dad in life by then?
Baltimore.
61.
He came to Baltimore in 59.
Oh, the year after the greatest game ever played.
But the year of
the championship.
The championship game, everybody forgets. The only championship, the only NFL championship Baltimore ever won in Baltimore. They won that at Memorial Stadium. They beat the Giants in Baltimore the year after the greatest game ever played.
Because everyone thinks of the Yankee Stadium game.
Right. And they forget that in 59, they not only won the championship as a repeat, they beat the Giants again in the only championship game ever won by Baltimore in Baltimore.
The man who always thought looked like a rotund Muppet, Weeb Eubank, he was the coach of the Colts then. He's the one that brought your dad here?
He was the Cleveland Browns offensive line coach when my dad played for the Cleveland Browns. So much like it does today, it's still a relationship business. When my dad got done playing, he coached for 2 years at Villanova, and Weeb Eubank called him and said, I need a line coach. I think you're the perfect guy for it. And my dad would spend the next five decades coaching in the NFL.
And a lot of those years in Baltimore. So you grew up in Baltimore. And he actually got a shot to be head coach 10 years later or so, right?
Right. 1972, the year Irsay arrives. Five games into the season. They're 1-4, and they fired Don McCafferty, who's my dad's best friend. And they make my dad the head coach. He didn't want to take the job because he was so close with Don McCafferty. But Don McCafferty said to him, look, if you don't take this job, they'll fire you with cause. And good luck feeding five kids. So he takes the job, and I remember the day he comes home. You know, I'm pretty excited. My dad's now the head coach of the Baltimore Colts. I couldn't wait till he got home that night, and I went running out and greeted him as he gets out of the car, and I give him this big hug. I was like, wow, congratulations. And he looked at me, and I'll never forget this, and he wasn't smiling, and he just said, I think you mean condolences.
He said that to you.
Yeah, oh, yeah, because he understood
what
the situation was.
You were, what, 10 years old?
Yeah.
Hey, just for a moment, Jerry. We have to go over this briefly. The history is, because it's kind of weird, right? So the Colts were owned by a guy named Carol Rosenblum.
Carol Rosenblum owns the Colts.
He owns the Colts. It's 1971?
1971.
Okay. And then Irsay, who is this air conditioning...
magnate from Chicago.
Air conditioning magnate from
Chicago.
Buys the L.A. Rams.
As part of the deal, buys the L.A. Rams and agrees to trade the Rams with Rosenblum for the Colts. So Rosenblum now owns the Rams, and Irsay owns the Colts. It's the only time in NFL history teams have been traded. You see players traded. It was a big talk this year when the Browns tried to trade for Jim Harbaugh as the coach. Teams were actually traded, and all of a sudden, overnight, Carol Rosenblum owns the Rams, and Bob Irsay, who owned the Rams only in name briefly, now owns the Colts.
Do you have any idea why they wanted to do that?
Tax reasons. They did it that way because by transferring ownership, by transferring franchises, Rosenblum, if he had sold the Colts and then bought the Rams, he would have had to pay capital gains taxes. But by doing a swap, he avoided the taxes.
And then Irsay's here. So this air conditioning magnate owns this team. This is the storied Baltimore Colts, right? Who aren't doing so hot by then, right?
Well, no,
71.
Well, here's what happens: in 71, they're in the
AFC
Championship.
What am I talking about? They go to the Super Bowl in 71.
Well, in 70, they go to the Super Bowl. The 70 season, they go to the Super Bowl. Right. They win the Super Bowl. The following year, they lose to the Dolphins in the AFC Championship game. After that, Rosenblum trades the Colts for the Rams. Irsay comes in. They're 1 year removed from the AFC Championship game, and they get off to a 1-5 start. They, you know, things were falling apart all of a sudden, and they fire Don McCaffrey. It's, I mean, it's an unheard of move, and they did it because Irsay was a clown who had no idea what he was doing, and he brought in a general manager named Joe Thomas. And Joe Thomas was a power-hungry guy who wanted to put his stamp on things, and he didn't want any success that he wasn't going to get credit for, so he was going to gut the place. And my dad knew this. You know, as any veteran coach knows, he saw the writing on the wall.
So this is a really weird time that your dad's in the he's in the midst of this. Joe Thomas has fired McCaffrey, your dad's old friend. Now your dad takes on this team. And he should be happy. He's got a shot to be a head coach, but he's leery of working for Irsay.
He's very leery because
Joe Thomas.
Every time he's been around Irsay, Irsay's been drunk. And every time he's been around Joe Thomas, he can tell Joe Thomas is a power-hungry guy who wants to build an empire. And, you know, much like coaches today, it's a relationship business. And if you don't work for people you trust, it's a bad situation because you work 14, 16 hours a day. And my dad knew intuitively. In hindsight, I realized this. He knew intuitively it was a bad situation.
When you speak to people who played for your father as an assistant coach with the Colts and then as head coach briefly with the Colts and then later as assistant coach with the Dolphins, what do they say about him? What adjectives do they use to describe John Sandusky?
Tough, fair, hard exterior, soft interior.
And how does that compare with adjectives you or your siblings would use?
Identical. He was the same person as a coach that he was as a father. I would say the happiest I ever saw him was as a coach on the sidelines in training camp when he was just teaching other people. That was the happiest I ever saw him as an adult male. The happiest I ever saw him as a father was when he was at one of our games. When he could just see us
playing,
in our element.
What, football or basketball?
Yeah, I was a basketball player in high school. My brother was a football player. He would never coach. He would never, you know, he would never ever say, you should have done this, you should have done that. He was just enjoyed watching us in our element. Those were his happiest spots. So here's how the roads intersect in Baltimore. Stan White, one of my broadcast partners on the Ravens broadcast, was a rookie on the team my father was the interim head coach for. So Stan and I have had a lot of conversations about playing for my dad and his type
Ohio
of personality.
State, right?
Stan went to Ohio State.
Ohio State,
right.
And he's a rookie playing for your father.
Yeah.
What does Stan say about him?
Same thing. He said, oh, yeah. He said, you knew your father was going to ride you. He was going to be tough. But once you got to know him, you realized he was doing it because he really cared about you. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to get the most out of you. The other thing guys have told me, and I saw this in my dad too, he was a great evaluator of talent. He could tell if a guy had the talent to play in the league. Not all coaches do. Not all coaches have that gift. My dad did.
What happened at the end of that season?
So at the end of that season, a couple days after the season ends, he gets fired. And then, you know, our world turns upside down. For the first time in my life, my father, literally for the first time in my life, he's not a Colts coach. And you know, everything that I thought was the center of the universe shifts. And he took a job with the Philadelphia Eagles, and we moved to South Jersey. And, you know, the world has never been quite as stable as it once was.
Could you talk a little bit about Johnny Unitas and your dad?
Yeah.
Because, again, this is sort of a surreal time in the history of the Baltimore Colts, what was going on there in 1971-72.
So, you know, Unitas was everything you've ever heard and more. He was an iconic figure. And the people who were around him knew how special he was, not just because of his star value. It wasn't like Joe Namath, where it was charisma and Broadway lights and all that stuff. It was more of a blue-collar type of a thing where you knew Unitas could get you out of a bind. Coaches knew if we can just get close, Unitas will figure out a way to win. And so there was this amazing chemistry of trust that you don't see in many workplaces or many teams, and it existed there. And there was great respect from my father towards Unitas because of that, because of the number of Sundays that Unitas had pulled them out of the fire. So my father's last home game as the coach, it's December, and they're playing the Buffalo Bills, and they have the Bills put away. And Marty Dombrace is the quarterback. And from the time my father takes over as head coach, Joe Thomas, the general manager, has told him Unitas cannot play under any circumstance because Thomas has already decided he's trading Unitas and he doesn't want any more accolades for Unitas. So it's the fourth quarter, and my father looks at Dombrace, who's kind of took a hip pointer on the last play as he comes to the sideline and says, "That hip looks pretty bad. I bet you can't go anymore." And Marty's told me the story. He said, I think I'm okay. I don't know. He said, "Look, I'm going to talk to John. When I point to you, just point to your hip and go thumbs down. Just don't even ask me a question."
Oh,
so my dad goes over to Unitas and says, "Hey, Marty's hurt. I need you to get in the game."
How much time is left?
It's the fourth quarter.
All right.
It's the same game that the famous banner plane has flown over Memorial Stadium that says "Unitas We Stand." It's that game.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. And so my dad goes to Unitas, and Unitas says, "Look, John, I'm not mopping up for anybody. Don't do that to me." He goes, "Oh no, John, Dombrace is hurt. I need you to get in the game." My dad wanted Unitas to go out on the field, so he points to Dombrace, and Dombrace points to his hip, thumbs down. Unitas says, "Okay," takes off his parka, starts warming up. The place goes bananas. Unitas goes on, hands the ball off a couple times. He throws the ball one time. It's deflected at the line, flutters through the air. It's like a glass of water that's falling off a table. You think something bad's going to happen. And this rookie receiver splits two defensive backs, Eddie Hinton, grabs the ball, sprints, goes the distance, scores a touchdown. The place goes nuts. And that's how Unitas ends his career as a Baltimore Colt. It's his last pass as a Baltimore Colt. So we're driving home in our Vista Cruiser station wagon. Back then, coaches didn't make much money. You had a station wagon so you could get the whole family in. And I look at my dad from the back of the station wagon in the rearview mirror, and I said, "You know, but what about your boss?" My dad was not one to use foul language around the family, but he just looks in the mirror and goes, "Screw Joe Thomas." And that was the whole length of the conversation. And in that conversation, he taught me there are times you do follow what you're told to do, but when it comes to it, you do the right thing, even if doing the right thing isn't the best thing for you personally.
That is a great story, Jerry. You get to the end of that season, you say your dad was fired. So he was out of a job, but he took a job in Philadelphia.
Right.
So now the family had to move again.
And the family splits at that point because we have five kids. And my oldest two brothers and my sister stay in Baltimore to go to college. And my brother Joe and I go with my parents. And so that was one of the things that I wanted to capture in the book is that you see people all the time. This coach, you know, he was here last year. He's here this year. People forget they have families.
Right.
You know, that's why I'm always super careful when I criticize coaches, because I know that coach probably has a 10-year-old at home crying. and I know that if that coach gets fired, his family might be split. And I lived through that. And I saw what that did to my mother, and I saw what that did to my family. And, you know, my family was forever split from that move forward.
You went to Philadelphia, though.
Oh, yeah.
As a teenager?
I was
almost a teenager.
No, I was in seventh grade.
Yeah. So you write affectionately in the book about your Philadelphia years.
Oh yeah, I learned a lot about life in the training camp of the Philadelphia Eagles.
In what way?
Most of the vices I was introduced by the other. I was the youngest of the ball boys. So when you're old enough, you get to go to training camp with your father, and it's one of the most magical things. I mean, you're a gopher. You go for this, you go for that. You get towels, you get water, you clean up. I mean, it's all menial tasks, but it's magical tasks because you're around NFL football players and you see your father in his joy all day, every day. And then in the evenings, you spend the evenings with the other ball boys in your own dorm we did in Philadelphia. So the head coach's son, Timmy McCormick, had figured out this way to steal beer from the coach's refrigerator and bring it back to the ball boys' dorm every night. So we would drink beer at night. You know, you're in eighth grade, you're drinking beer with guys in high school. It's a pretty big thing. And then he figures out a way to chew tobacco and all the things that as a parent you don't want your kid doing, we're doing in training camp at night.
Sounds ideal. He must have been the envy of teenagers all across
America.
Well,
there's no moms around to police anything, and the dads are all busy in meetings.
Jerry Sandusky is our guest here on Midday in this hour. He's written a memoir. It's called Forgotten Sundays, a son's story of life, loss, and love from the sidelines of the NFL. The foreword is by John Harbaugh, of course, the head coach of the Baltimore Ravens, who are getting ready to open up their new season September 7th as their first regular season game. Dawn in Annapolis, let's take a call. I said we could take some calls for Jerry while he's here. Dawn in Annapolis with a question for you. Hi, Dawn.
Hi. Jerry, I'm a big fan of your work.
Thank you.
And I wondered if you'd comment on your relationship with the Harbaugh brothers, given the fact that their father, Jack, is a legendary coach.
Yeah, I've had some great conversations over the years. Jim, of course, I covered when he played quarterback for the Ravens here briefly. And then John, I've gotten to know very well over the years. And their dad, Jack, I really enjoy talking to him as well. And John and I have had many, many conversations about growing up as coaches' sons. It's one of the reasons, if you look at the success John Harbaugh's had, you know, he does a lot of the things every other coach does, but he does a few things differently. He runs practice a little differently, and he's a much better game manager than most NFL coaches. And I believe it's because he grew up in a football family talking about situational football. I used to do it with my dad all the time. You know, it's third and four. There's a minute left. What are you doing here? You got this guy hurt. And when you grow up in a football family, that's the dinner conversation. You know, to this day, one of the things I miss most with my dad is we used to call it X and O-ing, where you just take a pad of paper and you say, okay, in a 3-4 front, how would you attack this? If they bring a double X blitz up the middle, how do you scheme that? We used to do that for hours. Huh. And John and Jim grew up in a household doing that. And it's why John seems at times to have like almost an intuitive sense of what to do right in the games. You know, he's not perfect. Nobody is. But he has that because it's not something you learn the day you become a head coach. It's something you learn when you're a kid. And I think that's what makes him special as a coach.
Did you ever think about becoming a coach?
Never. Of growing up in that world, I didn't want to work 16 hours a day. I saw the demands. Including Sundays. So it turns out I work 14 hours a day, including Sundays. But I didn't, you know, I just...
But your brother Jim has done some coaching.
My brother Jim coaches a boys' Latin. Now, Jim coaches a boys' Latin because he didn't want to go the college and the pro route. He didn't want to go through having your family torn apart. He didn't want to go through having to move. He didn't want to go through, okay, if we don't beat the Packers this week, we're probably getting fired. He didn't want to deal with the lifestyle impact of coaching in the NFL. That said, nothing made my father happier.
I'm curious about a couple of things. You said your dad didn't push you or your siblings into sports.
Nope.
Okay, and he didn't have much to say. He enjoyed going to your games, but didn't have much to say about the way you played.
Yeah, he would never, you know, he would never say, you should have done this, you should have done that. If you asked him questions, he would always give it out. I remember once my senior year playing basketball, I had, you know, this great first game. I think I scored like 25 points. I'm thinking I'm going to be all world. And the next game, I scored like 4 points. I'm missing every shot. What's going wrong?
Your senior year at?
High school, in Cooper City High School in South Florida.
Okay.
And so, you know, he was at my game, the second game, and he didn't say anything. He was just there. We were driving home. We're talking a little bit. And finally, I looked at him. I said, what do you think was wrong tonight? He said, tell me your workout routine this week. And I told him, he goes, yeah, you burned it too hard the day before the game because I noticed when you were trying to jump and move, your legs just didn't have anything in them. So the next game, back off a little bit the day before the game, and you'll have more. And sure enough, he was right. But he would have never said that to me if I hadn't asked him first. And I realize as a father now why. He was a great evaluator of talent. He knew I didn't have the talent to be a pro athlete from the time I was a kid. So he wasn't going to, you know, coach me up for no reason.
Right.
But as a father, he knew that space made me happy, and so he shared that space with me.
Hmm. I was just curious about one other thing. You played football.
In college. Football until I got to college.
Did he watch you play football in college?
No, he never saw me play in college.
Because that's right. You were in Towson.
He didn't miss much, okay. Dan, trust me. But he was always – busy coaching.
Yeah.
And then, you know, so while I was playing, you know, he never got to see me.
Oh, okay. Because I wonder what he might have had to say about the way your team performed. Would he volunteer criticism of a coach?
No.
Of a high school or college coach that one of you played for?
He took a different tact with coaches. And I saw him do this a lot with my when my brother Joe played in high school with the football staff there. After a win, he'd congratulate the coaches and let them go. After a loss, he would always take them out for burgers and beers. Hmm. And his philosophy was, when you win, everybody's your friend. As a coach, when you lose, nobody's there for you, so I'll be there for you. Let's go get a burger and beer.
And he didn't take them out to do X's and O's with them.
Nah.
Just to have a burger
just
and
to
beer.
Have a friend. Excellent. Just to have somebody who understood.
Jerry Sandusky is our guest in Midday. Another short break. We'll come back and talk with Jerry some more about his book, Forgotten Sundays, A Son's Story of Life, Loss, and Love. The Running Press is the publisher. That's an imprint of Perseus. You can find information about it on the Dan Rodrick's Facebook page. In a moment, we'll be tweeting out information about the book. You can join us here with a question for Jerry Sandusky if you want to talk about the upcoming Ravens season. We'll do that before the hour's out as well. 410-662-8780, the Midday email, midday@wypr.org. And welcome back. 410-662-8780 is our number if you'd like to join our conversation with Jerry Sandusky. Jerry with a G, Sandusky from WBAL-TV, voice of the Ravens on radio. We'll talk about the Ravens season before the hour's out and take some more calls for Jerry, who's written a memoir called Forgotten Sundays. Your dad had a great run in Miami, didn't he? He left Baltimore, yeah. And Don Shula, who was the head coach there, had just come off an undefeated season, right, with
right.
the Dolphins.
In 72, and then my dad came out in 75.
Yeah, so you ended up in Miami after the Philly years, and your dad was happy those years?
Yeah.
It must have been. That was a great team.
Very happy, great teams. It was a great place to be. They won again. You know, Philly, they lost. They lost for 3 years in Philly. So Miami was like Baltimore, where it was almost always a good team. You're usually in the playoffs. Big deal. Football was, you know, in Miami at that time, football was huge. It's not as big now.
Hmm.
Football was huge. It was the axis that South Florida revolved around in terms of sports. And it was a special time.
What gave you the bug for broadcasting?
You know, I was in college, and I was a finance and economics major in college, and I graduated with a finance and economics degree, and I started to interview for jobs, banking, sales, and I noticed two trends. One, none of the jobs really interested me, and two, nobody was offering me any of the jobs. So I'm watching a newscast one night with my roommate, God rest his soul, Sammy Zepka, and the sports comes on. And Sammy looks at me and goes, "You could so do that." I said, "You're right. You're right. I could do that." And so I moved back to South Florida with my parents, and I knocked on all the TV stations' doors, and I said, "Can I have an internship?" And they all said, "Well, you got to be in school." I said, "Well, I'm a college graduate. That's got to be better, right?" They said, "No, you have to be in school to get an internship." So I went, I found on the back of, remember those old Matchbox, they would have ads for broadcasting schools?
Oh, yeah.
So I found one of those. In Fort Lauderdale, it was a disc jockey school called the Brown Institute of Broadcasting. I enrolled in that, went back to the TV station. I said, "Okay, I'm enrolled in school. Can I have an internship?" And the one station, Channel 7, WSVN, said, "Sure, you can have an internship."
You told them you were in graduate school, right?
Right, yeah, I said, "I'm in school. That's all that mattered." And so I went in, and then the first day they said, "Okay, you can have an internship, but we don't have a program."
They don't have a program?
Yeah, there's no internship program. You're welcome to hang around, but that's all our internship.
What did they give you to do?
That I just watched for a while. I literally hung around the TV station for a year and a half, and then I learned how to edit and produce, and every so often something would need to be done, and I would do it, and gradually I picked up a little part-time job and another part-time job, and I just moved up the food chain, and then by the time I left there, I was the weekend sportscaster.
What was the station again?
WSVN. It was the NBC at the time, and now it's a Fox station.
What did your dad think of that?
He thought I talked too much. He was a man of few words.
He was not like that, right?
No. But
screw Joe Thomas. That was it.
That was it. You know, he was a man of few words. I'm a man of many words. But he respected that I had the courage to follow my dream, and he supported that. You know, I mean, here I am with a college degree. I show up back home, and I said, basically, Mom and Dad, can I live rent-free? And they let me do that.
So WSVN, the sports anchor, and you like the work?
Oh, I love the work. Yeah. And I kept showing up, and it just seemed like a great way to make a living, and I had a lot of fun, and you were around sports, and it was in a culture I was used to, and It involved sports, it involved words, it involved people. I thought, this is a good way to make a living.
Let's take another call for Jerry. This is Scott in Baltimore with a question about the work he's done over the years as a sports reporter, sports anchor. Hello, Scott. Scott, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Go right ahead. Yeah, go right ahead.
Are you there? My apologies. Had you on the speaker. Jerry, Dan, I'm glad to talk to you. Jerry, I'm a huge fan.
Thank you.
What I'm most interested in is sort of the art of reporting sports. You just mentioned you have a great relationship with the Harbaugh brothers, and at the same time, you got to cover them. And that goes for a lot of players. I mean, access to players is key in covering them. If you make them angry, sometimes maybe the access goes away. How does a sports guy deal with that?
I think the critical principle at play is fairness. And I'm very careful not to socialize with a lot of guys. It actually gets easier as you get older. When you start off, you're the same age as the players. And it gets a lot easier when you become the same age as the coaches, because the players have no interest in socializing with you, and I have no interest in socializing with them. Mm. And what you find with people in terms of relationship is I'm not looking to be their friend. They don't need more friends. I'm looking to make sure they know I will be fair with them. That's all I've ever asked when anybody covered my father. You know, John Stedman was always fair in dealing with my father. I never forgot that. Vince Bagley was always fair in how he handled reporting on my father. I never forgot that. And I've tried to apply that same principle, whether it's John Harbaugh or Richie Leone, you know, the rookie free agent punter who just got cut last week, and the other day, rather. And there are a couple things you learn. One, pronounce everybody's name correctly. Everybody wants their name pronounced correctly. You don't have to be right all the time, but people have to believe and have to know that you're being honest all the time. And then be fair. Understand that they have families. They're not trying to make mistakes. They didn't show up to screw up. Sometimes screw ups happen. Be fair and put things in context. And I'll give you an example. In today's day of get everything out quick, fast, 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 during the Ray Rice incident, John Harbaugh was asked at a press conference where I was attending, somebody said, how does this affect the way you structure your backfield moving forward into the regular season? And Harbaugh said, it's no big deal, blah, 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 we've been ready for this, and he went on. Well, that night on ESPN News, the quote shows up, John Harbaugh, speaking of the Ray Rice suspension, it's no big deal, blah, blah, blah. I was like, whoa, that's totally out of context.
Right. He didn't say
that's not fair.
He didn't say the allegation was no big deal.
Correct. Right. And so I think when people are treated fairly by you and you establish a track record of being fair, then you get that rapport that they can trust you.
What about on the other side of that? The Ravens, for instance, you're the broadcaster of Ravens games. They ever put any conditions on what you can say on the air?
Never.
And do you ever? You don't feel that?
Never.
Like if there's a story to report that needs to be reported, you don't feel like you're limited in what you might say about a player or a
nope.
suspension, anything of a serious nature like that?
Not in the least. And it's one of the things I think that separates the Ravens from other organizations. There are other organizations that will tell you, this is the no-fly zone, you can't go here. No one in the Ravens has ever come to me and said, you can't touch this issue, you can't go here, or after a broadcast said, you shouldn't have gone there, that was wrong. Nobody has ever done that.
But back to your father, John Sandusky, the subject of your memoir, the main subject. After 43 years as a player and a coach, how did he come to retire? What was the end for him?
The end for him, he was 70 years old. He was having a hard time moving around anymore. He wasn't sure if he was going to get another operation to make it in the last year. And so he had a hallway talk with Shula that lasted less than a minute. And basically, without addressing it, essentially said, you know, it's time to retire. They both realized it was time to retire because he didn't know physically if his body could make it through another season. And that's what, you know, that's what coaches do. If you are built to be a coach, you coach until you can't do it. So he retired from the NFL and he started to coach a high school team. He became a volunteer coach. He would coach the coaches. He'd coach the players. And it was called MacArthur High School. And he loved those kids as much as he loved his Dolphin players. And he did that for 5 years.
You know, there's a couple of tough things in the book that we haven't dealt with here in our time together, Jerry. And one is a loss of a brother that your family experienced, your parents suffered, you suffered, and then the loss of your mother at the age of 58.
Eight.
And then your dad, when was the first sign of the onset of Alzheimer's after he had retired?
It was, he was 75 years old. He was celebrating his 75th birthday party. And we all of his kids, we flew down for the party, And I had a conversation with him. We were talking. It was me, him, and Dan Marino, and the topic of salaries came up. And I said something along the lines of, you know, how much money did you make when you were playing in Cleveland? And he said, you know, I can't. I think in Philly I made like $500. It was like a bizarre passing. I didn't think twice. I was like, wait a second, you didn't play in Philly. You coached. And then he, you know, wandered away. And I looked, and I gave Marino a double pay. And I really didn't think too much of it. Actually, I thought, maybe he's had one Manhattan too many or something. You know, it was a party, but no big deal.
Yeah.
And then in hindsight, I looked back and realized that was when the tumble began.
And the tumble lasted about five years.
Yep, 5 years until he passed.
Right. Because that sort of covers the loss part of the subtitle of your book, Life, Loss, and Love from the Sidelines of the NFL.
Well, and the other part of the loss was watching my father deal with loss as a man.
Yeah.
You know, I lost my brother when I was 17. After we moved to South Florida, things are going great, and my brother goes off to college. He was a great football player, my brother, and he was on scholarship at Tulsa. And his sophomore year, he calls home one night. He thought he broke his ribs, and he died the next day. And he died from something called sepsis.
An infection
that he didn't know he had. And so that completely devastates our family. And I watch my parents go through, you know, that was a time where there wasn't much family counseling available or sought. And so I watched my parents struggle through this just immense pain that they both carried the rest of their lives. And then 7 years later, my mom dies of cancer. And it was the first time in my life I realized that cancer is a physical manifestation of your thought, of your spirit. I mean, this was a woman who was, you know, just never able to pull her spirit back together.
After the loss of Joe,
it was just devastating to her, to our family, to me, to everybody. Mm. And so I had to watch my father wrestle with these, you know, as I was wrestling with them. But I had to watch him plow through this and deal with the pain. And then as it gets to the end of his life, and he's on the last stages of his life, my brother Jim and I are visiting with him. And as Alzheimer's patients will, every so often, they'll get this little slice of clarity. It doesn't last for long. And in this case, it lasted maybe 30 seconds. And he looked up and he's like, oh, gosh, it's so great to be with you guys. Thanks for visiting. And we're having this 30-second conversation. And he paused and he shook his head and he said, I never thought it would end like this. I never thought my life would end like this.
Wow.
And then he looked at us and looked me in the eyes and he said, live now. Don't wait. Live now.
Forgotten Sundays. The last question. What do you mean by that title?
So, as I went through writing the book, I realized that there are no forgotten Sundays. You leave an imprint behind.
Because you thought
on the lives you touch.
You mean you thought you had missed your dad all those Sundays because he was an NFL coach?
No, I never missed him because I knew he was in this place of joy. Right. But at the very end of his life, I thought he had forgotten it all. He had forgotten it all. And I realized
that it's there somewhere.
It's there in the lives you've touched.
Yeah.
It's there in me, in my kids,
yeah,
in their kids.
That's so true.
It lives on.
Well, it's great to have you on the show, Jerry. And I really appreciate your memoir, your spending time with us and sharing this story about your dad, John Sandusky.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you. And the hay is in the barn. That's
there you go.
That's become your signature line when the Ravens win a game.
Right. When the moment comes where the win is guaranteed, the hay's in the barn.
And I understand that's on a T-shirt now.
It's coming
out.
We're going to have T-shirts that will come out just prior to the first game. And for every T-shirt we sell, we'll raise money for ALS and we'll raise money for the Brigants Brigade.
Excellent. And the Ravens, what do you think?
I always think good things.
Yeah, I think good things.
Always think
they're
good
looking
things.
Good. They made some improvement. What do you
think? Oh, yeah. I think their offense is going to be one of the great surprises in the NFL this year.
We'll see. Listen for Jerry Sandusky of the Ravens broadcasts and his book, Forgotten Sundays, A Son's Story of Life, Loss, and Love from the Sidelines of the NFL. Again, the publisher is Running Press. Information about it on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page. Thanks, Jerry.
Thank you, Dan.
And thank you, everybody, for tuning in. That's our midday for today. See you back here tomorrow.
Midday Senior Producer is Nikki Gamer. The Associate Producer, Michael Hemowitz. Our engineers are Matt Taka and Luke Spicknell. Our interns are Connor Graham and Marjorie Goodman. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcast and live streaming available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.